turn this on. So Keith, the first thing is, just please, just give us your name, what you did, and what you're doing now.
I'm Keith Wood. I've got this name of the Yorkshire Phoenix. I've now decided that 76, that I'd got to do something to keep my mind going. Although I'm reasonably fit, there was no way was I going to walk from John O'Groats to Land's End. I thought, what else really can I do? And so I decided that I'd have a crack at writing novels.
I have to say, Keith, that you look a very fit 76-year-old. I could actually imagine you doing that long walk. You look very, very healthy, sir. It's lovely to meet you. What I'd like to just sort of put into context for our listeners, first of all, please, is just a little bit about your background to see whether that was part of what inspired you to become a writer. So what did you do in your previous life?
I was in local government, and really my experience of writing was limited to technical reports. I was an environmental manager writing technical reports, and I thought that this was something, actually writing novels was something that would be relatively easy to continue with. What I have found out, of course, is that it's an entirely different set of skills that's required. Having said that, it's great because I'm starting to learn new stuff. You say I'm 76. I was 76 3 years ago. I'm now 79.
We're looking to help you.
Yes, and no pills or anything like that. I've got no medications whatsoever.
Is it the facelift that's done it then? Is it the Botox?
No, I don't do anything. I don't do anything like that. I keep away from the doctors and just keep going and laughing. And that's the big thing is, you know, and that's really the way that I operate, is that if I can make somebody smile every day, then I've achieved something. I'm really happy. But on top of that, I'm achieving more than that. I'm achieving more now. I'm still learning. I'm still learning to write, and I'm diversifying into writing plays and writing murder mysteries and stuff like that. And I'm always open to suggestion from people. And also, criticism, as long as it's constructive criticism, because we all get knocked back if people say, well, don't think that was very good, or think it's absolutely useless. But, you know, you've really got to sort of harden yourself.
And I think that's something that's really important. There's some friends of ours who are musicians called the Dumbwells. We kind of had a long chat with them in a previous season. And one of the things that Joe said to me was, and it stuck with me, actually, and I wish I'd heard this many, many years ago, was that thing of, you know what, we've achieved already, we've had our career, we've achieved things, and now when you've retired, don't have that fear of failure anymore. Try things. Now, I know that if 100 people said to me, Roy, that was really nicely directed, that was really good, that, but one person said, oh, I didn't like that, that was the thing that stuck with me when I was younger in my career. And I found it really upsetting and really hard to get rid of that feeling. How do you deal then? You say about that, we were chatting, weren't we? You were saying you had sort of one bit of criticism. Do you deal with that differently now than you would have done when you were in your career then?
Yeah, I do. It still hits you. It definitely still hits you. And you think about it a lot afterwards. But now, at 79, I feel I can say what I want. I'm not worried about what people think about me. And sometimes perhaps I go a little bit over the top, but I just don't care anymore on that. You do take it personally. And certainly for younger people, I can quite see that it would be a bit more of a problem, but it doesn't worry me now, no.
So let's just turn the clock back just a tiny bit, Keith. Now we've kind of established that you are writing novels. And we want to talk about that a little bit later on, about what the novels are about and how that came about. Let's talk about that day, though, that you actually were made redundant, because I think that's a huge factor in our lives, being made redundant or taking retirement, obviously, and how that affects people. How did that affect you at that time?
Basically, I died. I felt that I died. As soon as I was in community development, and I was talking to lots of people every day, all at once that was shut off. complete shutdown. And that really, it just did suck all the life out of me. I had other things, in that I had a wife that was ill, suffering from dementia and getting worse. And for the next 16 years, I was basically a carer and isolated from everybody else. And it got to such a stage that basically I'd had enough and I was going to finish it. On two occasions, I decided that I was going to commit suicide, because I'd got nothing worth living for. And my daughter saved me. I phoned her up and told her what I was going to do, and she started crying and being a stupid old sod. I sort of backed down, and obviously I'm pleased about that now. But, of course, there are circumstances. At that time, I ended up with no money, no furniture, nowhere to go. Yes, I still owned half a property, but that's not much use to keep you going. So really, it was a low ebb in my life, and that was 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago as now.
And how did you then turn that around? How did you get up in that morning that you got up and went, I'm going to do something different here and get on this path to start writing?
Well, I started to really look around and think, well, if I'm going to live a few years longer, what am I actually going to do? Am I going to sit and watch television all day, or am I going to, what am I going to do? And so I decided then that I was going to rejoin the real world, and I started to work or go to business networking organisations and meet other people who really still had a purpose in life, basically. And to join that community, I really had to start up in business myself.
And that was across all the age ranges, wasn't it?
It was. So that's why I thought of a name for the business that I was going to start, and I called myself the Yorkshire Phoenix, because I felt as though I was rising from the ashes again. And 3 years later, I have to say that I've risen from the ashes. I'm now in a completely different area. I've made a new set of friends, and life is great again. And I feel now that I've got my 19-year-old life back when I was 19, when I got married, get commitments, I'm on my own. I just feel as though I've got everything to live for. And I feel now, well, maybe not 19, but I certainly do feel 15 or 20 years younger than what I used to do. And I feel much better for it.
Yeah, I'd like to keep thinking I'm 19 as well, but unfortunately when I get up out of this chair, when all the creaking and the moaning goes on, it won't be the leather chair, it'll be my knees. So I know how you feel. And I mean, that is inspirational though, Keith, because that could have easily, very easily have gone the other way. So it's a fantastic story to hear, and thank you for sharing that with us, actually. So what made you decide to go into writing? Have you called upon personal experiences in your writing, even though you do historical novels? And what actually inspired you to do historical novels rather than current day novels?
I was never particularly interested in history at school, the way that it was taught in those days particularly. Don't know what it's like now. But I've always been interested in heritage and culture and of this great country that we've got. Although it gets knocked a lot, there's a heck of a lot to be said for Great Britain and for England. The reason I went for 18th century stuff, basically, I suppose, was I think it's a period where not a tremendous amount has been written about. What has been written about, as in most ages, is about the rich and the famous. I'm interested in finding out about the ordinary people, the social history, injustice, social injustice, and of course, in the 18th century, women that were just classed as a man's chattels, there was a lot of injustice against them. And therefore, my main heroine now is a woman called Nellie Chapman. She's from Mansfield, and she's a woman before her time, and she's not going to be dominated by men. Very interesting character. And she's the one now that I'm writing continually some sequels for. I was confronted by a strong feminist lady a few weeks ago who said that she'd read one of my books and she said she wanted to know who actually wrote them. And I said, well, me, Keith Wood. She said, but you're a man. So I said, well, yes, that's true. And she said, but this has been written by a woman, simply because of the sympathetic approach to women being downtrodden in the 18th century. So all of the books aren't really about that, but they're really, all of them, you can read them for a bit of fun, the same as you would read any sort of book probably, but there is an underlying depth to it because I write from the heart. I don't write from my head. I don't do it because I think that I'm going to make a fortune out of them. But I do it, and I would hope that people can look at it and think, this guy is writing from the heart, and there is messages in here, messages about justice and injustice and equality, without it being hard fact like you do get with some of these things.
Can I ask you, though, you created a character, and she sounds a very powerful character. How, though, I'm trying to sort of offer advice to people that were interested in doing a similar sort of thing, Keith, how, though, did you put her into context, into telling her story? Because it's great having a character, but obviously you've had to write a story around her. How did all that come into being? How did you make that happen? Was it a chicken egg situation?
From the purest writer's point of view, they tell me I don't write properly because I write what I call organically. It's seat of the pants stuff. I start off, and now I've got my heroine, or some people might call her an anti-heroine. Now that I've got that, I start off with an idea. Now, what you're supposed to do if you write a book is you're supposed to have, if you like, a storyboard of start, middle and end. So you know it's going to end before you start writing. I don't. I haven't got a clue how it's going to end. I haven't got a clue what this character is going to get up to. And other people who she meets along the way, there are quite a lot of characters in all my books. They're all about different, the three that I've produced, they're about three different characters, but Nellie is the one that I'm now going to be honing in on. And it just really evolves organically. It's something. And I've got that freedom to do that. I also tend to write in short paragraphs. Now, again, they tell me that is wrong. But I've spoken to people. I've spoken to people with dyslexia. And I've shown them my books and I've said, what about this? Is it in the right font? What do you think about the way that I've got these short paragraphs and stuff like that? And they said they find that quite good. And even people who aren't dyslexic have looked at that and said, yeah, that's great. And I can pick this book up and I can put it down at any point and know where I've got to and get back to it.
And that must inspire you to sort of keep writing.
Well, it does, yes, yes.
Can I ask, if you've come up with the heroine, you're coming up with the story as it evolves, how on earth, though, because I mean, this is something that fascinates me, is how on earth, well, we've got a blank piece of paper in front of us or a blank computer screen. How do you start? If you're, you know, if someone is sat at home now thinking, I would love to write something, whether it be something that relates to my own personal experiences in life, whether I can put that into a story. But the most difficult thing I would imagine is, how do I put that first word onto the page? What did you?
I don't think that is difficult. I think if you try to follow guidelines and rules, yes, you might find it difficult. Don't. My thing is, don't be influenced by what other people tell you how to write. It's your book. It's your idea. You write and you say what you want to say. The thing is that when I start, probably before I get to the end of the book, I've probably written it about 125 times. I've read it through 125 times, and each time I change it slightly. So the first word doesn't really matter too much. The first book that I wrote, I gave it to somebody who I met who was also an author. He looked at it and he said, scrub the first three chapters. He says, do away with them. They don't do anything for the story. Now, normally I disregard what people say and do what I want. But I looked at it again and I thought, yeah, I think he's right.
So that kind of comes to that, that's that constructive criticism that we talked about.
Exactly.
Which you need to be able to exactly. listen to, assimilate yeah. that kind of information yeah. about whether you're going to take that on board or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's still your book.
It is.
But you do need to listen to other people.
Yeah, but destructive criticism doesn't really do anything. Doesn't do anything for you. If people can, don't mind people criticising, as long as they do it constructively and, you know, reasonably. And I will actually consider it. One of the things that I'm doing at the moment is murder mystery for a friend who's wanting to start up a business in it. And I did 5 different versions before I felt it was good enough to take out to review. And I got her to review it. And she came back with a big long list of things, saying that she hoped she didn't offend me and all this carry on. I wasn't offended at all because what she was saying was right. It was constructive criticism. And I'm on now writing using her guideline because she's got the experience of the acting side of things. And now I know I've nearly finished the next chapter, the next version of it. I've altered the title of it. And in actual fact, when she gets it back to review it again, she'll probably say, well, the names of the people are the same, the characters have altered, they're much more developed, and he's taking notice of what I've said, you know, because it was constructive. That's better for me. I'm still learning. I'm still, without a doubt, I don't have all the answers. But all I do say, and people have started asking me, because they wanted to write books already. And they've said to me, what advice would you give to somebody who is wanting to start writing? And I said, the big thing is, don't take much notice of anybody else. Just start writing it. It's your book. Do it as you want. But you will alter it. You will alter it, whether you get criticism from outsiders or not. You'll do it because you'll start criticising it yourself.
I would imagine actually then that's quite difficult to actually to put a stop to something going, I'm satisfied with that. I remember making programmes. We used to do documentaries. And when you first saw it, you thought, well, we got that final cut, what you thought was going to be the final cut. You go, I can never get better than that. That's it. I might as well retire now. But then you look at it 6 months later and you go, oh, I could have done that. I could have done that. I don't know whether you feel that the same about your books, but I suppose in a way you're then going on to write another book so you can develop elements within that yeah. next book.
Yeah.
Do you use sort of some of the locations that you knew when you were growing up as a child? Do you use
yes,
some
sir.
Of the locations? There must be things that imagine it would be far more difficult to say write about a story in Japan or America or something if yeah. your childhood was here in Yorkshire, for example.
Yeah, I mean, my second book certainly is a very personal one. The one that starts off the series with Nellie Chapman is basically, it starts off in Mansfield, but it goes very quickly up into North Yorkshire, where I started work on a country estate when I left school. So I know the area intimately. It's still there. I've been back recently. It hasn't changed very much at all. It's the best place on earth, as far as I'm concerned, up in the Hambleton Hills, and you're looking over from the North Yorkshire moors up to the North Yorkshire dales, right across that valley, and it is a wonderful place. It's really inspiring. You can go up there and you can park for free, which is marvellous these days, and you can sit there and really enjoy it. I know the area well. I know the moorland well. I was involved with a country estate, so I know that sort of background. So I've got all that. As far as the characters are concerned, well, and also locations. I mean, the first book is set at in Eckington, near Sheffield, an area that I only moved back to 3 years ago. And really, that was one of the things that started me off with the first book was a newspaper report from 1767 in a Nottingham newspaper when this guy from Heckington was hung at Gallows Hill in Nottingham. And it was from that I started things off. And the only bit that I could get about the book was his christening, because there was no birth certificates in those days. First time you got any mention was when you went to church. So I had his christening in Eckington Church, and it was mentioned in the report when he was tried and hung. It was mentioned that he was a wandering minstrel. He had an affliction, which I think now we would call cerebral palsy, that he was made fun of, which led him to murder somebody in the end. So I didn't know Eckington, I didn't know Derbyshire before that. So there is a lot of time. I mean, people say, how long does it take you to write a book? Actually, writing the book doesn't take too long. It's the research before, and when you're doing historical stuff particularly, because I do think that historical things, really, you do need to get the facts right. And because you're... But there's an upside and a downside. Because you're writing about nobodies, just anybodies, any normal people in those days, there's nothing much being written about them. So you have free scope to make it up as you go along. Whereas, of course, with the rich people in the world, they've already had stuff written about them. And it would be very easy just to make a story up around them. And of course, rich people do come into it, the dukes and the lords and whatever. But they are not the feature of the book. It is about the ordinary working class man and the sorts of justice and injustice that there was in those days.
So just drawing to a close, I just wonder how you see success in your own mind. What is your hopes and fears for the book?
As I say, I don't write for the money. I write to keep my mind active, and it does that. So I've won already. Getting it published, getting something published, and it's got your name on the front of it, is an achievement if you've never done it before. So it's great. There's something to leave behind. Maybe in 100, 150 years, somebody will pick that book up and think, who was this Burke who wrote this? But I don't mind that. I don't mind being a Burke. At 79, you can be what you want to be. And it doesn't matter if people think that you're a prat. I'm not bothered about that. In fact, I've been doing some aura farming this last 3 years. As I go around, and I can tell you now that I can go to almost any organisation in South Yorkshire, North Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire, and I can go into a room and somebody will come up to me and say, hello there, Keith. And I haven't got a clue who they are, but... I said to a woman the other day at a meeting that I was at, I said, I'm sure I've seen you somewhere before. And she said, yeah, of course you have, Keith. I'm such and such, and this is where we met. And it's great, because it makes you start to feel as though you are part of area. Even though, at my age, I've moved into a completely different area, don't know anybody. I've got a very good neighbour that I've now got. But, you know, I never knew anybody, and now I know loads of people.
And that's really interesting, actually, because I would almost imagine that there is a danger of encouraging people to do writing, which is fantastic. I'd love to do it. But it is quite isolation. It is quite isolating, potentially. And one of the factors that we've discovered over the season of doing this is that something that you lose, that contact with other people, if you're not careful. So it's interesting to hear that you say that actually there is a huge circle of people that you get to meet because of your writing?
Because of the business networking, basically. It's the business community in this area that I go and I do a lot of that. It's what I call this new word of aura farming, which is supposed to be on the internet.
Yeah, I wonder what on earth that was.
It's getting yourself known. Apparently it's in the dictionary now. It is actually a dictionary word that aura farming is.
See, my day has been worthwhile already. Now I've got a new word that I can forget by tomorrow, obviously. But
people do it on the internet to get themselves known when they're nobodies. I do it on a personal basis because of my background in community development. I love meeting people, and as you can probably tell, I love talking to people. I love getting to know new people. And this is something, so the business community is what I do. I go around. So that isolation, yes, if you aren't careful, you can spend days and days just at a computer. And I'd start to die again on that one. Although I live through the books, because when I'm writing, I do live through the books. I know Nelly very, very well. Nelly, who never existed, she does to me on a personal thing. And the other characters in there as well, the ancillary characters, some of which do speak with a Yorkshire dialect. So anybody reading my books, I was told that if I wanted them for the American market, I would have to change them into Oxford English. I told them to clear off, that there was no way that talking to a Yorkshire farmer in the 1700s would they be speaking Oxford English. If you go up into the Yorkshire Dales now, a lot of them still don't. A lot of them wouldn't understand a lot of the words. I told the proofreader that that was a red line that I wasn't going to go across. I couldn't do that. And she said to me, well, then in that case, what you've got to do is put an appendix in, which I did take notice of that. I do take notice of people sometimes. And I put an appendix in. And it's quite surprising. Even people in the UK who have reviewed my books and have looked at it have said they really appreciate that, because it's not only people abroad that wouldn't understand Yorkshire English. There's many people in Yorkshire, wouldn't they? Because there's not just one Yorkshire dialect.
I mean, I've lived up here for 40-odd years. I've played village cricket, and I've been stood there going, I mean, taking it all in, but not understanding a word. Well, now that's part of the charm of it. I mean, it's just part of the character of living in such a stunning region.
Now thou knows, lad.
Thank you. you talked earlier on about Yorkshire tea. I understood that. I think my final question to you would be, if I come back and see you in a year's time, what do you hope has happened to Nelly, and what do you hope has happened to the development of the stories of the books?
I know what's happened to Nelly. I know what's happened to Nelly. Even though I don't know the end of the story when I start writing, I've got a bit of an idea. And I was going to kill her off. But I'm in love with her. So you don't kill something off that you're in love with, do you? And in some cases, she's not very nice. But I still love her. I'm not going to tell you, because you'll have to buy me a book and read it, but you'll enjoy it. I can tell you, you'll really enjoy it. What chapter that I'm on at the moment, I'm really loving it. So,
yeah. Thank you, sir. I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much indeed, Keith. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, thank you. It's been a pleasure meeting you. Thank you.